So my dad at 16, right? He said to me, he's never done drugs. He didn't even drink excessively. He said, while you're taking drugs, I will always be here for you, but we're not going to have a relationship, a proper relationship. And that was an ominous warning there.
Yeah.
That was a warning there that maybe, okay, family, my dad's always provided for me. My mum always been there nurturing. That should be enough for me to be like, okay, maybe I shouldn't go down this road, right? But I just didn't have a relationship with my dad until 27 till I got clean. That's how much the drugs drove me.
I'm Paul Scolfort, and this is Powerful. In this series, I come clean about my own sobriety and the journey it took for me to get here. In each episode, I will speak to a special guest about their addictions and how they achieve sobriety and how they maintain a happy lifestyle today. So today, I have the pleasure of introducing Jack Curran, who's 28. He's our youngest guest on the show. Jack's story is about ketamine use and ketamine addiction, and it is a huge subject and a big drug out there now. So if there's any young listeners, please take this as an ominous warning. Jack's ketamine addiction has caused him catastrophic physical and mental damage. Jack has turned his life around and is soon to be a fully licensed counsellor. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Jack, thank you very much for coming on. This is Powerful. Really appreciate your time, mate.
No problem.
You are the youngest person that's to come on the podcast, which is great. Because there's such a need for younger people in drug and alcohol awareness. So I really appreciate you being on, mate.
Thank you.
We've clearly got a lot in common. We were talking before about boxing and different sports and stuff. Where are you from and how was your upbringing, mate?
Okay, so thanks for having me on. I just want to say thank you for that. It's always a pleasure to be able to get on anywhere and spread a message, whether it's in the street or whether it's on a podcast, etc. So yeah, I'm from, I grew up basically most of my life in Bexley Heath, which is on the borders of South East London and Kent. And yeah, I'm 28 years old. And yeah, I grew up, let's talk about my childhood. It's like, I grew up in a loving family, you know? You know what I mean? I grew up with love, compassion from both mum and dad. Nothing on paper would have set me out, looking back at it, as to become what I become in addiction, etc. But yeah, I come from love, compassion, and holidays, just a normal upbringing, you know? I'm not just normal. I didn't feel different.
We spoke about boxing earlier. Tell us about your boxing.
So yeah, career. Sport for me as I was growing up was a massive part. And looking back at it through what I do now, and I understand that that was my solution to life and kept me on the straight and narrow with discipline, etc. And before boxing, football was my fix, right? And I played football from 6 years old to about 15, 16. And I played for Charlton Academy, like in the trials. Like I had a long 16-week trials. And that fear then that we talk about, like I never felt really good enough, but I just carried on through discipline through my dad, and then played football, and then boxing come and cricket come into probably about, boxing was about 10, cricket was about early secondary school.
You mentioned fear, and this is a thread that runs through this, and I'm glad you said you had a lovely upbringing with your parents and they're really loving stuff, because not everyone does, but it's important to clarify that that doesn't necessarily shape you for someone who can have problems with drink and alcohol. But you talked about fear. Mm. When did you notice that you had fear as a young kid?
So if I can paint the picture to the listeners, it's like, I remember on a Friday night, I'd have cricket on a Saturday. And I was so obsessed about playing cricket because it gave me ease and comfort. It gave me joy. It gave me purpose. And I'd sit there on a Friday night. This is long before phones, so you just check the weather. And I'll be staring out the window, looking at the clouds, with this dreaded feeling inside me going, if it rains tomorrow, if it looks like it's going to rain tonight, it's going to rain tomorrow and cricket's going to be called off. And for me, that was fast forward for the same as the drug dealer telling me at 2 o'clock in the morning, he's not turning up. That dreaded, yeah. That fear inside, that I'm not going to be able to do something that I really love and enjoy. And that was the pattern of my life. It's like, as much love and nurturing I got from my mum and dad and the materialistic things, they were sort of fighting a losing battle because that ease and comfort that they could give me externally wouldn't fix the internal fear that drove me, you know, the fear of just wanting to keep going and just feel ease and comfort all the time. When I'd be sitting there in my thinking, that's when it would just drive me, just different scenarios, past, future stuff. And it just drove my childhood in a positive way and also a negative way, you know, because I was constantly in fear of the future, what's going to happen, et cetera, et cetera. And no matter how much my mum and dad loved me or nurtured me, that thinking, that way of thinking wouldn't necessarily go.
It's really well said, because a lot of people in recovery and sobriety talk about that they felt they was born with something and they felt that they was different. And I've heard it explained really well, that this guy explained that he was born feeling at dis-ease, and he had a really good childhood as well. He never felt at ease with himself. Mm. And when he found sport, or he found motorbikes and then finally drugs, it gave him a feeling of ease. So he was at ease with himself finally. But what happened for him was that when he was on the drugs, in the end, he was at dis-ease when he was using and at dis-ease when he wasn't. So mm-hmm. then he was gone.
Yep.
So what was that? What do you think, you're born with addiction? Like, how, what's your perception on that?
I don't know. I really don't know. But I know that through the earliest childhood memories, looking back now, and it's not that at the time I was sitting there at the window looking at the clouds thinking I'm in dis-ease and discomfort. It was just a normal feeling that I just went into, like, in how I could say, into survival mode. It was just normal for me, right? It's only now working, going through fellowship and looking back at my future through therapy, etc., etc., that I can see a distinct pattern in my thoughts, feelings and behaviours around certain stimulus. And that's where I can look back now and say, even though I had the love and nurturing, something in my thinking wasn't right.
Yeah,
something drove me, and that for me was fear. And I talk about, my dad was really, especially around sport, was like critical. He always used to say to me, I'm your worst critic. And I used to think sometimes, well, I'm my worst critic. but it was always coming from that critical place. And he would always tell me around, I can't show fear, I've got to be strong, this, that and the other. And it's that, when it talks about that corroding thread which went through the fabric of our lives, it's like, as a kid at some point, which I don't know where, I sort of swallowed that.
Mm.
And that was now going to drive me for the rest of my life until I found something sufficient enough to give me ease and comfort, which went from sport to money to then drugs and then now recovery.
I remember there was, I think it was my fourth fight in a place called Sudbury.
Okay.
And I'd won my first three fights, two on stoppages. And the kid I was fighting had beat everyone in my age group and weight group in my club. Mm-hmm. I used to belong to a club in Howard Wood called Alma. And I'd been matched with him. And I was literally thinking, he's beat some really good kids in here. Mm-hmm. And I probably started to show a bit of nerves. And I remember my dad turning around to me and literally saying to me, you look nervous, stop it.
Yeah.
Like, stop it now.
Mm.
I was thinking, okay, how do I stop it? He's like, sit still and don't move. And it was interesting because I felt like it was the wrong advice at the time. I felt like saying, come on, Dad, you know. But I understand now as a father what he was trying to do, because he knew I was good, but I probably didn't know I was as good as what he thought I was, you know. Mm. So I understand it now as an encouraging thing. But at the time, I took it the wrong way.
Mm.
How did that work for you as boxing with fear? Because for me, in between matches, I would obsess about it and I couldn't sleep. Yeah. And I never understood about the obsessive mind, because that's how I used to be. And in hindsight, I understand about it now. How was that for you, boxing?
So I jeopardised my boxing for eating. If that was a big part. I was always quite a small kid. not humongous now. I could never, eating was a big thing around boxing to give me ease and comfort, and I know I shouldn't do it because I couldn't ever make weight. I would struggle to make weight, and I would use food addictively. And I remember sneaking down to the fridge trying to get, my dad would be so strict that he would try and lock the fridge. He'd do anything to try to make me stop eating, right? And that coincided with boxing in a negative way. But when we talk about fear as well, I have definitely similarities to you. I never felt good enough, even though my dad, my coach, my peers in the gym would rate me and think I'm a good boxer. Inside, I never felt good enough, right? But I wouldn't portray that to them. I had this mask on, and this is looking back now from hindsight. I had this mask that I've got to portray to them that I think I'm good enough. And even though I would be scared before fights, to the point of feeling sick, all that nerves, that butterflies, that intense, dreaded feeling, I spent a long time trying to cover that up to just look calm and collected and just portray to the other people that I'm all right.
Yeah.
When really, it was just a mask. I was just trying to make everyone feel that, okay, he's cool.
Sad, Nick, because you were a good boxer, right? Where did it take you, your boxing?
So, yeah, I boxed in Ireland, I boxed in France, I boxed some good boys. I think I won my first 8 or 9 fights with no losses. And then as soon as I lost, right, I take it here, it's like, as soon as I lost, it was like that self-fulfilling prophecy, I'm not good enough. As soon as I lost, I had them 9 fights and the evidence was telling me, bloody hell, you're doing well, I'm good. So even though my head was telling me I'm not good enough, I could look at the logic behind it and think, do you know what, I'm actually all right because I ain't lost. But as soon as I lost my first fight, I'll never forget when I lost my first fight. It was in the ABAs and the schoolboys.
Yeah.
And I remember walking into that changing room, sitting in a car on the way home, and my dad's silent because he's gutted, right? And I'm waiting for my old man to absolutely give me a spanking, right, verbally. And that was a crap performance, left, right and centre. But I remember just sitting there thinking, this proves to me I ain't good enough.
It's really sad, isn't it? Yeah. So did you carry on fighting after that?
I carried on fighting to about 15, I'd say 15, year 10. And I think altogether I lost about 4 or 5 bouts.
Yeah.
Won a few more, but it's like since that first loss, it's like it took my heart out of it, really. And we have a lot of people, and I can see from my friends in my club who are now pro, who have had good careers pro, they use their losses as a learning tool,
yeah,
to be able to progress, to be able to go, okay, this is where I went wrong, this is where I'm going to go. That positive mindset, where me, as soon as I lost that first time, all the wind was knocked out of my sails and I thought, oh, what's the point sort of thing, you know?
Yeah.
That negative connotation in my mind, I'm not good enough, it just all became true in that experience, and the eating got worse then. The lack of training, I'd be sitting in the sauna, me and my mate Luke, the trainer's son, because we were both chubby. And I just lost the discipline around it, you know. And in cricket, I started playing cricket, like that was getting good. I played for like a feeder team. And I was playing like at 14, 15 for like the ones and twos. Like I'd open the batting for the twos. And these are big men.
Yeah.
But they're big men bowling really fast at my head, right? And I was full of fear then, but that was like a real fear because I was scared of getting hurt.
That would hurt.
Yeah, but it wasn't just when we were playing the fear, it would encompass me the day before.
Yeah.
And I'd be so scared of projecting forward of these big geezers bowling at me, and I'm only 14, 15, and they're 20, 25, 30. It would encompass me well before I should be fearful like a normal person would as they're going out to bat. But yeah, and it would drive me and everything, and it'd just be that constant of, you're not good enough, Jack. You're not good enough. When logic and experience and talent says different.
Mm.
And if I would have just disciplined myself and took away the thinking, I truly believe I would have got somewhere, whether it be in boxing, whether it be in cricket, whether it had been in football from an early age.
It's hard though at that age because, you know, we don't all come along with a mindset coach. Mm. And we have, you know, it sounds like your father was like mine. He could see all the potential and he wanted to drive it, and it was probably quite cold sometimes. But I think in hindsight he probably saw that I was overthinking things. And I love the acronym in recovery, which is false evidence appearing real.
Yep.
Because you picture something negative and then an emotion follows that picture.
Yep.
And even though you haven't got out of the bath yet or wherever you are, you've already lost. and it's already happened. And I think this is really important for people to understand that I believe that it happens to everyone, but I think if you have addiction tendencies or alcoholism tendencies, that that is amplified, you know, and can stop you from doing stuff until you're in recovery.
Yeah.
When did you first have a drink or a substance?
So my mates were drinking long before I started using anything or drinking. And I was so disciplined in my sport that that was my solution. I didn't need that external stuff in the park, smoking cigarettes, doing bloody spinning with alcohol. And I never really, alcohol was never my thing, ever. And I'll say about 16, I'll say in about year 11, it's like I was at that turning point then. Do I want to actually put more effort into sport, or do I want to go down the path of with my friends at, in the street, being a nuisance, basically. And that whole experience of the last few years in sport, failing, I just thought, you know what, I'm going to go this way, go down the smoking weed. That was my first substance I started using. And it weren't even a substance that made me feel good. It was just I feel like I fitted in. I feel like I truly fitted in. Whereas with the sport, I felt, okay, I'm not good enough. That then segregated me and my mind from my mates in the gym, et cetera, in the cricket team. But when I was out smoking weed with my mates, I didn't feel no different. And that was the start of my substance misuse journey.
It's a lot of awareness to have, because people don't even have that awareness. And it is about comfort. So as human beings, it's about trying to find where you fit in, isn't it? And if you have that mindset where you feel like you don't fit in, or you failed in what you're doing, or you're not good enough, or it brings in fear, then the obvious road is to go down is the other one, which is, you know, the other option. How did that impact you then? Because I know for me, being fit, I love the feeling of being fit and running and doing something and athletic. And I didn't initially like to, I started to, a lot of my friends started smoking weed and stuff early on. And when I smoked weed, I didn't really like the feeling initially, because it kind of dumbed everything down. But the drive to fit in was overriding that feeling,
100%.
Which later on in life, I enjoyed too much. How was the process from smoking weed then, mate?
Yeah, so I just started smoking weed out with a new set of mates. From the gym, I met one of my good mates. I've known him for a long time, and he was there with his mates from school. Yeah, and I just integrated with that social group. And yeah, like I said, the weed, over time, at the beginning I didn't like it, and over time I started to like it, right? And just fitting in with my mates, that was the drive at first. But then quickly I started noticing, like, I am a bit different around these substances, because where we would go out and get weed, I'd always have to take some home. I'd always have to smoke some at home. Even though my mum and dad would be going mental because I'd smoke it out my window in my room. My mate Harry, my best mate, he used to say to me, and this is about 16, 17, why do you have to take it home? Why can't you just smoke it with us? And I couldn't answer him, because I didn't actually know why. I just knew that I liked to smoke in a joint at home on my own. So that was the start of looking back at the differences to where my addiction started taking me, to the point of dependency and the point of needing it in every social setting, but also on my own in a segregated setting.
So needing to take it always home, did you know that was different from other people then? Because your mate told you as well, didn't he?
Yeah, so... Yeah, my mate said it to me, and I just had a justification that I liked it, you know, because there wasn't enough consequences for me at that point to see that it was a problem.
Yeah.
And that was all it was, and it wasn't a big thing with me and my mates. It was just, for me, I just done it, and I felt like it was normal. I got most of the jip from my mum and dad, because stinking out the ass with weed, and that didn't even stop me. So I could see then that consequences I was even getting from home, even if they were quite small, whether it be the shouting and my dad going mental at me, that didn't stop me. I still done it.
Was it, do you think he saw that his son, that was a great cricketer, boxer and footballer, was now turning the corner into wasting his life?
So my dad at 16, right, he said to me, he's never done drugs. He didn't even drink excessively. He said, why are you taking drugs? I will always be here for you, but we're not going to have a relationship, a proper relationship. And that was an ominous warning there.
Yeah.
That was a warning there that maybe, okay, family, my dad has always provided for me. My mum always been there nurturing. That should be enough for me to be like, okay, maybe I shouldn't go down this road, right? But I just didn't have a relationship with my dad until 27 till I got clean. That's how much the drugs drove me.
It's quite, as a father, it's quite a courageous move for him to put that out, to lay that out to you, isn't it?
Mm.
On the other end, it's hard to hear and understand that when you've got something that's actually providing you with comfort and ease and whatnot. Where did that progress to?
So for the next few years, just progressed into harder drugs, cocaine, MDMA, party drugs, right?
Yeah.
And I can't sit here to the listeners and say that they were horrendous, were bad years. I had thoroughly had good times, raving, all the party scene, right?
Which is totally normal if you're raving because that's
socially acceptable.
Yeah.
But looking back now, they were the years that built this addiction, that built this wrath, this monster inside me that was going to come back and bite me in the arse pretty much. And even though, it was good to a certain extent, I didn't know the monster I was building inside of me that was going to come back and absolutely tear me to the point of physical, mental, emotional death, pretty much.
Were you working through this period, Jack, or was it?
So I started at about 17. I did work for my dad from 16 when I left school, but he sacked me because there we go. I constantly can't follow direction.
Yeah.
Want to do Jack's thing on the phone in the warehouse. It was welding and fabricating. Didn't really want to be there. It was just my dad trying to grab on to just drive me in the right path, even though all the logic and evidence is telling me otherwise. Mm. Telling him otherwise, he's just trying to push me somewhere, give me opportunity, and so he sacked me from there, from a little situation that happened that was all joking, but it got a bit too far. And then I started working in a stage building company at festivals, building festival stages, and I enjoyed that because it was. The ethos in that industry is rock and roll.
Yeah.
So that was everyone
perfect
was off
cover up.
everyone was off their nut. It was self-employed. I could work when I want to work. And I would just choose the jobs like the We Are Festival, the Creamfields, the stuff that would be party orientated. You could just go to the festival for free, stay there, work there. And it suited me at that point.
It sounds like a perfect recipe.
Perfect recipe for disaster. Yeah. 100%. And after that, I was dipping and diving in life, just trying to make money from criminality pretty much. And that's how I knew that instant gratification of money was a big thing because money facilitated my drug use.
Yeah.
So that coincided with my addiction to substances because I needed the money to fund it. My mum and dad weren't funding it.
So it's gone now from work to doing criminal stuff to get the money.
Criminal activities, that started while I was at work. Sorting out people with different, being middleman, doing this, that, and the other, trying to help other people out. And I'm not proud of this, but this is just my experience, my story, right? And then I had an accident at about 19 years old where I got beaten up outside a nightclub on my own. I broke my tibia, my ACL, my MCL.
Bloody hell. Yeah. Proper.
Yeah, I got battered on my own. I woke up, I got old Bill around me, these, what are they called? People that preach Jesus and at the night time with all the clubbers, I can't remember what they're called now, but they found me on the side of the road. And after that, I had a few operations to re-correct my legs, but in Blackheath Hospital, private hospital.
I know it is, yeah.
Because I had it in through Alpenden, I can't remember, Farnborough. And they done a re-corrective surgery, but it pretty much failed. And I remember walking down the road a few months later and my nan drove past me and she said to me, she thought it was an old man walking. So when she come to my ass on that day, she offered to pay for me to go Blackheath because she knew how much pain I was in.
Yeah.
And after that, all that stuff that happened, all that
was that in blackout, Jack?
I was drinking this was still in the party stage, but that was the catalyst there. And what that was driven by was ego, right? Because the original fight started in the club and I already knew I was handy with my fists. I didn't like fighting. I was full of fear, full of fear. But the fear of looking like a melt in front of my friends and not backing it, as you'd say, overrid the fact of me getting beaten up and potentially life consequences.
Yeah.
And that's sort of how it happened, you know? And then I got caught on my own and this, that and the other happened and I ended up after the operations, getting diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. Seronegative, which means that I don't have the rheumatoid in my blood, so I technically haven't got it clinically, but I've got all the symptoms. But they found it really hard to manage because they couldn't give me the normal rheumatoid arthritis drugs. So I was on every prescription pill, 30-something pills at some point.
Wow.
Because I couldn't walk, and that's when I started delving into ketamine.
Yeah.
Because I noticed that it really helped with easing my pain, but then also easing the thinking, the self-pity, the fear, the negative connotation to everything. Because at that point, when I'm lying in bed on this machine that goes up and down to keep my legs working after the operations, I'm in so much self-pity. I'm thinking about, even though I ain't done sport or boxing in quite a few years, I'm thinking, oh, I was a good boxer.
Yeah.
Oh, I could have done this, could have done that. All these if, buts and maybes, right?
Which would make sense if you're strapped to a bed, having your legs, trying to get them working again.
And then I'm thinking, what am I going to be like when I have kids at 40 years old? How am I going to play in the park with my kids? All that stuff that would just feed this self-pity, this horrible feeling of self, my self-concept, right? And I started using ketamine, and what I found is it numbed. Because at that point, I've got rheumatoid arthritis, which is not under control. The inflammation in my body, in my fingers, in my elbows, is going through the roof.
It's really painful.
Yeah, my CRP, which is your inflammation level in your body, should be between 1 and 10 for a normal person. Mine was 150 to 200.
Wow.
So I was like an old man then.
Yeah, it's bad.
And ketamine, what ketamine done for me then was something that I definitely couldn't do for myself. It helped with my physical pain because they weren't medicating me with analgesia good enough, pretty much.
Yeah.
But that ended up coming back to bite me in the ass because I ended up on fentanyl through the hospital.
Wow, I didn't know they had it over here.
Yeah, OxyContin. I was addicted to OxyContin for 6 years. That coincided with my ketamine, which we'll find out a bit more in a minute.
How long was it for your legs to go back to in working order? Because it's quite a traumatic thing.
I've never gone back to working order. I can straighten this leg fully nearly, but this leg was the one that done the most damage, and I can probably straighten that 45 degrees off straight.
Right.
But then what happened is the trauma response from that incident set off an autoimmune response, and now my immune system is attacking my joints, so I can't straighten my arms, can't straighten my fingers. And this is over time, this is developed to the point where my tendons calcify, my bones are calcified together, and they seize up pretty much. So that was the start of my addiction, heavy addiction to ketamine. And my life from then took a downward spiral.
Yeah. Mm. So when you come out of hospital and stuff, was you literally like a daily user for ketamine? Could you still go out with people, or was that a home use?
So the weed that I was smoking every day before that and getting on the party drugs on the weekend, all of that went out the window, and I just used ketamine on a daily basis. Started off a gram every few days. Tolerance was low, so I could afford to do that.
Yeah.
But quickly, within 6 months, I'm using 5 to 10 grams a day. That's how quick the tolerance builds with ketamine.
Yeah. Which is quick, and that's a lot.
Hell of a lot.
Yeah.
And
for those who don't know, ketamine's a horse tranquilizer, so it's pretty powerful stuff.
It's an anesthetic, a sedative. And what it done for me, was just numb my mind, helping my physical pain. And I started using that addictively, and the tolerance build up happens comparison to other substances extremely fast. But then on the other hand, what that means is you're putting so much of that substance, grams and grams of that substance, in your body, and your body can't process it properly. I'm not a doctor. Whatever happens, and the consequences physically, let alone emotionally, but physically, are dire.
Did that start with you? Because it makes your bladder porous, and it causes all sorts of problems inside. Mm-hmm. Did problems from use of that happen quickly?
Yeah, so the first problem that I had was something called ket cramps, which is, for overuse of the substance, your bile duct and your gallbladder, your bile duct produces bile to break down fats and food in your body. That is overworking, producing so much bile that it becomes inflamed pretty much. That's my understanding. And you get these bile duct gallbladder attacks, which is like someone stabbing you, like you've been winded. Yeah. It goes all the way around to your back. And just to paint the picture of where my addiction's got at this point, the powerlessness, I would remember the first time I had it, I was at the pub. I come home because I started feeling horrible. And I remember screaming on my bed, crying, screaming for my mum at 21 years old, like a baby, right? And saying to this, whatever's up there, something in the universe, please stop this, please stop this. I'm never doing this again. I'm never doing this again. An hour comes and it subsides. I'm back at the pub using again. Because my head goes to me, that one justification has a bit of depth and weight in it. It won't happen to me again. And then, to be honest, it weren't that bad. I've got through it.
It's incredible how that happens, isn't it?
Incredible. Because it was absolutely horrendous. It's the same as me touching a hot stove and then touching it again tomorrow.
Yeah.
It's exactly the same. And that was the pattern of my life for the next few years. And then...
Did you seek any help at any point?
Yeah, so... On? Sorry to interrupt you. Yeah, so at about 22, the bladder problem started coming severely. And I'm using ketamine now. I'm up to using an ounce every few days. I was buying it in bulk. I had the people around me that I could get it. And I was so worried about running out that I just used to get it and I used to have so much. With the thinking in mind, I'm going to ration it out, as we all do if we're trying to control something we cannot control. And I remember being at work. My dad got me another job trying to help me, which I was there for about 3 weeks. My pubic area sort of swelled up and went like blue and I could not go to the toilet and I was busting. Imagine busting to go, but you can't go. And then I finally got something out and it's blood, jelly. And I rung my dad crying like, Dad, I think I'm going to die. Because I didn't have no knowledge of what this stuff actually does to you.
Yeah.
And the severity, you see blood and I was in full of so much fear that I rang him and then a few days later, I'm put in my first treatment centre.
How was he on that phone call?
Scared.
Yeah.
First time to, I sent him a picture. And because he probably thought I was being a bit of a hypochondriac, right? My dad's quite stern, quite a man's man, right? But to send him a picture and show him what was coming out of me, I think it scared him because he first signs that his son's actually getting physically ill. And no matter how much he said to me at that 16-year-old there, we're not going to have a relationship. He's my dad, right? And he always said that, look, I might not like you, but I love you.
Yeah.
And he will do anything to help me get better if I want to help myself.
Did he know you was using that much at the time?
No, he didn't know I was using that much. He knew I was using it, but he sort of, in a sense, not wiped his hands of me, but sort of just let me get on with it, what I want to do. Sort of, he says, I'm going to have to pay the piper at one point. If you want to do all this stuff, you take the consequences, right? But I think his love for me and the fact he's my old man, when push comes to shove and it was critical or I was in that much pain, etc., he would be there.
He's always sitting in the sidelines.
Yeah.
Waiting.
Through my mum.
Yeah.
He'd guide my mum of what to do. My mum would, no matter what, would be there. My dad's booted me out and my mum's come with me. That's how much my mum's been there for me. And I'm forever grateful for both of them.
Yeah. When you first went in to treatment, how was that?
I thoroughly enjoyed it. First time where I'm speaking to people that understand my thinking, not my using. I weren't bothered about that because I knew I used a lot, but I always felt different in the thinking, right? And that was the first time I speak to the clients in there, or my peers, as you want to call it. And I thought, bloody hell, you think like me and then you use like me. There we go. I'm in a place where people understand me. The counsellors understood me, understood where I'm coming from, where no one else did because I was in so much fear of being so honest with people that I wouldn't ever say it. I wouldn't ever be truthfully honest. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because it's different levels of honesty in society, and you can't walk into a pub or stuff with your mates and say I'm feeling vulnerable. I have all these thoughts go on, and most places wouldn't accept it. It's getting better now.
Yeah,
but it would. You know, when I first went into a treatment centre and then into meetings, I was like, oh my God. I'm not weird, like people think as I think. People have the paranoid thoughts of all the fear, what's going on and stuff like that. Did you stay in there for a full term?
28 days, and I come out, and this is where the ego manifests and Jack knows best. It all comes straight in because as soon as I start getting well and I'm physically all right, I'm not weeing blood, I've put on a bit of weight and I felt a bit better about myself. I've come out with the idea that, okay, I'm a ketamine addict, but I can still go and drink and use cocaine and do the social using. That went down extremely well. I relapsed after 2 days.
Good plan.
Yeah, and my dad then, that's when I first saw the factor. I really thought he was done with me because in his eyes, he's just paid 15 grand, I think, for a treatment centre.
Yeah.
And within 2 days, I'm back using substances. And within a week and a half, I'm back using ketamine again. And that was the first realisation for me that I'm in a bad way here, because if rehab can't fix me, my dad thinks rehab's going to fix me, I thought rehab was going to fix me, where am I going to go?
Yeah.
And I went into an NA meeting after that, but I saw the word God, and I thought, I don't know about this. They seemed a bit happy, I weren't happy, and I'm thinking, do you know what I mean? I just want these to like me. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? But it's weird in my life. Like, I always wanted, there's a lot of people I didn't like, but I always wanted people to like me. Even if I didn't like you, I really want you to like me.
Mm.
And that was the drive through my life. And I felt so different that I felt that everyone didn't like me because I was young. And in that time, and that was 8-9 years ago now, there weren't a lot of young people in the fellowship. Not at the meetings I went to anyway.
Yeah.
And I felt that enhanced my feeling of feeling different. So I didn't go back to there too much. If I did go, it was just to please my mum and dad. Excuse to get out of the house, excuse for this. And I carried on using ketamine again for years now. And I was still going out with my friends when my legs would let me and I weren't in pain, belly or bladder. But slowly and surely, as I was creeping up to 25, 26, I started segregating a hell of a lot more, because the physicalness of my arthritis, the physical damage from my arthritis, and the physical damage from the ketamine was just getting so dire, so bad that I couldn't go out and feel normal or try and even put on that facade that I am feeling normal, because I look so ill.
Yeah.
And I could see it. And it weren't like I could even ego my way out of it and try and pretend that I'm this sort of person, because inside I was dying, but it actually showed on the outside as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No fake tan or vitamins will sort that out, will it?
Nah, not whatsoever. There was no way.
The damage you're doing with the ketamine, what was it actually doing at that point? Because still a lot of people over a certain age doesn't know about ketamine and don't really understand what it does. How was that affecting your body?
So where it took me at the end, I'll just paint a picture for where I was at the end, yeah, because this is where I went to on this substance, right? And this is why I like to raise awareness of ketamine, because I work with loads of people that are 21 and they were where I was at 27. And it just shows the damage this stuff can do in a quick space of time. But yeah, I remember sitting there in 2022, 6'12". I had 10% of my bladder left. A normal male bladder should hold 500 to 700 mil. My bladder holded about anything between 30 and 50 mil when they done a urodynamics in the hospital, which is the test of how much your bladder can hold. I had jaundice, so my liver was pretty much packing up. I don't know the science behind that, why you get jaundice, but I had yellow eyes, yellow face, I looked green. My kidneys were overworking and getting backed up with urine because my bladder cannot hold the urine or release the urine. I'm urinating parts of my bladder. I've got ulcers in my bladder. I'm in constant agony, constantly with a hot water bottle, wearing nappies for 18 months. My mum's going to do a weekly shop buying me adult nappies. Emotionally tortured, demoralised in every aspect, physically, emotionally, spiritually, anything you want to go down, I was absolutely demoralised. And I knew, this is the worst thing, I knew why it was because of the substance, but I had no power of choice in taking the substance, because I got into this rut. And this is why I'm so passionate about this stuff, is because it's so dangerous when you get into this rut. So through my experience, through arthritis and etc., I got put on OxyContin and fentanyl. So I was heavily addicted to that. I was abusing that heavily, especially OxyContin. And that's the highest analgesia pretty much the NHS can give you, which only can be prescribed, I think, by a pain specialist. That's who prescribed it to me.
And that's so addictive, OxyContin.
Heroin.
Yeah.
That's it. It's just synthetic heroin, right? And that never touched the pain. With my bladder, never touched it. The only thing that would give me ease and comfort physically through pain was get more ketamine.
Wow.
So my solution to the pain was ketamine, but ketamine was causing the pain.
Yeah.
So I'm in this catch 22 now that I'm killing myself, trying to medicate myself. And that's without talking about the actual addiction and the thinking and the fear and the self-pity and all this stuff, the not feeling good enough. That's different to this. So if you've got the addiction in the mind and the physical addiction to ketamine, it's a scary, scary, demoralising place, and that's where I ended up.
It's a prison with no way out, right, at the time. So was you at home still with your parents? Were you just basically locked in your bedroom?
Yeah, so, yeah, that's where it was for me. I was in, my mum and dad were just grasping at straws. They sent me to another rehab in 2021. I come out, got 6 months clean. And my bladder was still bad at 6 months clean. But I had the new clobber on, I felt good. I was going out. I weren't using, but I was delving back into criminality because my addiction for money started manifesting now again. And I want to get quick, easy gratification. And I felt good. But this is why, as an addict like me, it's in the thinking. So now the external's starting to get a bit better, but my internal's not getting better because I'm not in a fellowship, I'm not working a program, I'm not doing no recovery. And within 6 months, something happened. I lost my license. And boom, that was the end of the world. The dread come. And it's like I had that mental blank spot it talks about. And I was using again. And then 8 months later, it's like I took that first bumper kit. 8 months later, it spits me back out. I'm sitting on my bed at Christmas Day. All my mum and dad are playing Monopoly downstairs as a family. And I'm sitting there wanting to kill myself. Because I'm 6'12". I look yellow. I'm wearing nappies, as I explained to you a minute ago. And that's what it is. I wasn't taking care up here. I might have been getting better externally, naturally, because of the time I've been off ketamine and OxyContin. But at 8 months, I was back on the OxyContin again, back on the ketamine again, even stronger, even more amounts, doing up to half ounce plus a day, which is a hell of a lot for your body to process.
Huge amounts, especially, and if you're that weight as well.
Yeah, I weren't drinking enough. I was probably drinking 500 ml of water a day. I couldn't eat. Every time I'd eat, my bile duct, because of the amount of blocked it is, I'd just be sick. I'd get in kidney pains. I was, at that point in 2022, ready to die.
It sounds like a living hell.
Yeah, and that's how I can paint the picture. And I spoke to so many ketamine addicts since, due to the awareness I've been doing. And there's a lot of people out there like that at the moment.
From that, did you go back into treatment, or what was the point where you're like, I can't do this anymore? I've got to change everything.
So for me, and I speak to a lot of parents and they're like, when will my son or daughter get this? And it's painful for me to say it, but there has to be that readiness inside of them and that willingness and that desire to really stop. And how that manifested for me was, I actually knew from speaking to urologists, speaking to professionals, but take that away, inside of me, inside of Jack, right, I knew that I ain't going to make another 6 months. There's no way physically I can make another 6 months. And it was getting to the point where mentally I just had so many pills around me that it felt so easy for the first time in my life just to kill myself. But I didn't really want to hurt myself in the process, sort of thing. It's like I wanted to kill the addict, but not Jack. Because I'm trying to control something that I have no control over. And it's absolutely killing Jack himself. And I got opportunity again by my dad. And my auntie helped. I got to go to treatment again. And in treatment, the first time, I got another opportunity to go to a sober living afterwards, right? And I remember on the phone to the geezer, and he was like, do you want to come? I can get you the assessment. And everything in my thinking was going, no. Even when evidence suggests to me that the last two rehabs, I've come out and pretty much done the same thing, whether it be straight away or within 6 months. But something in me, that inner consciousness, took control. That's how I could best explain it. And I just went, yeah, I'll go. Even though my head was going, no, you don't want to go there. It's going to be full of these mad people, etc. And I rocked up to this place in Southend. Obviously, I'm from Bexley Heath. And I rocked up in Southend and with a parent, with my suitcase, with my mum and dad, that bloody hate me, but they love me. They've shown that through what they've done for me and always been there for me. And yeah, I rocked up to Southend into a sober living house. And the boys in there, give them their due, they were a bit further in than me, in there doing the program of Cocaine Anonymous, and they took me to my first meeting, like in the Southend. And that's where my recovery journey really started, Paul.
What was it that gripped you to go in to recovery? For me, it was finally being just exhausted. And just, I just, you described it really well, and I think it's really important. A lot of people take their lives because they actually, but they take the life of the wrong person. They want that addict or the thought process to go, but not really themselves. And I hear that a lot in recovery. What was it that gave you traction this time that was different from other times you went into treatment?
For me, physically, I was going to die. And I knew that wholeheartedly that it didn't matter what everyone else said to me, because my mum and dad, my nan, my missus, all these people, my friends would say to me for years, you're going to die. But I didn't think I was going to die yet. It was at that point in that Christmas that night, because my emotions were so high, because I felt like I should be downstairs, all that stuff, that I had this clear clarity point that if everyone's saying I'm going to die, even the professionals, and inside of me, I thought that I'm not going to make it to the summer of 23. So it was like then that's when I sort of pressed to go to rehab again. And it seems so selfish, but I didn't really have another option at that point that I thought of. And I believe then once I knew inside, that's when these opportunities for secondary housing and stuff started coming up once I got put in treatment. But it was the physical aspect for me. Yeah. I didn't want to use for a long time, but I have the thinking that will take me back there. If I could just say no, then it would be great. It'd be lovely. I wouldn't need a big book. It'd just say, just say no, right? In fact, I've got that no mental defence that when that thought comes in, I'll make a justification at some point with so much depth and weight that I will use again, no matter if external tells me I can't. I will internally, I will rationalise it and be like, yeah, that's sweet. I was so tired and I knew deep down that I can't do this and no human power can help me, that I've got to go into the meetings and actually do that. But I need to get clean first from the OxyContin, which is a detox, plus obviously get clean off the ketamine and get to a point where in society that I can eat a bit of food and get out there and actually get to a meeting, because I was so physically ill I couldn't get to a meeting. That's where it started for me. That's what changed.
And now
I'm 22 months clean and sober off all mind-altering substances on the 25th of this month, so 2 years in January.
Oh, well done.
God bless, man. It's I'm proud of it, you know. I'm proud of
it. Be.
Yeah, and I give the glory to my higher power, right? But I've done the footwork. Do you know what I mean? And God or whatever you want to call it, it's not going to get me to the meet. It's not going to get me doing to the podcast and trying to spread awareness, get through the steps, all that stuff. I've put the footwork in, but the rest of it, yeah, I give glory to the rooms, the program, etc. And I'm 22 months clean, and my life, for the first year, was quite hard because this is why I'm big on this as well, the consequences for ketamine are not just you go to 28-day treatment centre, and this is just physical consequences, and you come out and you feel like a new man and you look like a new man. For me, I come out and I didn't look that much different, and I was still in agony with my bladder. My bladder took 9 months to a year to stop hurting.
Wow.
And that year was a bit torturous in the sense of, I know what will fix this pain, and that's where my head would take me.
Yeah.
But due to working the program, I managed to create a mental defense through doing what I need to do, through the step work, etc., sponsor, good people around me that I never used in them hard times. Now I look back and I think, God bless us. I'm so glad. And this is why I want to do all this stuff, to show other addicts that are in the same place as me around ketamine that it's not easy, but there is a light at the end of this dark tunnel you're in. And I'm proof of that.
I think it's amazing because it's, I know going through my process, but listening to you, it is, I can feel it. It's so dark and painful. What a crazy journey. But to come on the other side and now use all of that as a gift to help other people, it's incredible, mate. Yeah. It's a really good thing.
Yeah, that's it. And that's what I do in my life. I'm doing the counselling. I'm in my last year and a half of that to be a trained therapist. I work in a treatment centre myself, step-by-step recovery. I got my first flat, pay tax, all these things.
You sound very normal.
There we go, I'm a normal member. On my gratitude list this morning, I said I'm grateful just to be on the train like a normal member of society.
Yeah.
And that's what I've got today, but I've still got that fear. I've still got that, can get into that self-pity mindset. I've still got all these emotions, which are human. but I've got a way to work through them. I've got a way to understand I don't need to use ketamine no more to give me ease and comfort, because I've got something substantial enough to give the same effect, whether that be prayer, meditation, meetings, etc.
Yeah.
And that's what I've got today, you know. I've got a relationship with my mum and dad. I'm a good brother.
Cool, your dad, your parents must be relieved now.
Yeah, but they do know that this addiction's a life sentence, right?
Yeah.
They do know that. But they see, not through words, they see through action what I do and what I'm willing to do and my desire to not only get myself clean, but to help others through working in the treatment centre, through social media stuff. They see that what I'm trying to do, you know?
Yeah.
And that's it, you know?
That's powerful, Jack. And lastly, if there's someone listening that needs help or has problems with ketamine, who's not sure if they're on the fence, or a sibling or a son, what would you advise them to do?
Reach out to professionals, you know, and or it's not even that. Just for me, the program of Cocaine Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous, that's what's changed my life. Yeah, but there's also there's rehabs, there's people that have understanding, so you can always reach out to me. My Instagram will be on the bottom of this and my socials. But, get professional advice and just... It's hard because if you're a family member, it's sort of in the person suffering themselves when their desire comes to put the action in.
Mm.
And I know it sounds horrible, but you can support them in a way, but it fundamentally comes down to them. But, yeah, just reach out and just speak to people, whether that be your mum, your dad, if you're suffering, or... people in the rooms or myself, just speak out to people and speak about how you feel and what you're going through, because you can't get help unless you speak out.
Yeah.
Don't ride this roller coaster, this dark roller coaster on your own. Just speak out, reach out, speak to people that maybe understand. My Instagram, my socials are always on and I'm always trying to respond and help others. And I just want to let you know that there's light at the end of this tunnel, whether you're in the place I was, wanting to die, just have a look at my experience and you'll see that there's hope. And then also, if you're 16, 17, starting off this journey, just look at my experience and see the carnage that could potentially come if you're like me.
Yeah.
But that's my message, you know. Just keep fighting. There's always hope. And even though you might be scared, fearlessness is not the absence of fear, it's the presence of courage. And that's what I try to live my life by today. No matter how scared I am, if I meet fear, with courage. I'm a fearless warrior, and that's what you need to get through addiction. So God bless.
Jack, thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul.
It's amazing. This podcast is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also make a donation. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. And if you enjoyed This Is Powerful, please rate, review, and follow the podcast to share it with your friends, your family, anyone you can, and head over to social media. I always love to see and hear how you react to the episodes, and it's so helpful for our content to be shared. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica and Marty, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Henry, you know who you are, and to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. And there's a whole catalogue of episodes wherever you get your podcasts. But did you know you can also watch it on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with Paul Scofield.
Tired of waking up with a hangover?
Or just of generally feeling anxious with limited memory and a suspicious itchy feeling in your crotch?
Yep, we are too. I'm Vic.
And I'm Hamish.
And until recently, we were your average binge drinkers. Until we gave up and started the Sober Awkward podcast.
In it, we take a deep look at every aspect of sobriety. The funny, the weird, and the plain awkward.
So join us every week as we say cheers to a more authentic, confident, sober version of ourselves. Did that sound a bit cheesy, Haim?
Yeah, you sound like a total twat, but they were going to find that out soon enough anyway.
Yeah. Listen to Sober Awkward wherever you get your podcasts.